I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC 93.9. We're online at WNYC.org. Why are some leaders terrible, others merely adequate, and only a rare few able to achieve true greatness? James McGregor Burns, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian whose pioneering book, Leadership, almost single-handedly spawned the academic field of leadership study some 25 years ago, takes a fresh look at that subject in his latest, Transforming Leadership. He is a senior scholar at the Jepson School of Leadership Studies at the University of Richmond and the author of numerous books about history and government, including biographies of FDR and JFK. This one is published by the Atlantic Monthly Press, and I'm pleased that it brings Professor Burns back to my show today. Hello. And now you're the title of one of the best-selling books in the country is also Leadership, written by Rudolph Giuliani. Do you get royalties for his use of your title?
Yeah, I thought there might be a little spin-off from Giuliani, but I'm not really expecting it.
You looked at George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Woodrow Wilson, and FDR in this book, but you haven't written about any of the more recent presidents. Do we need more time to pass before we can?
Well, for one thing, those early presidents, Leonard, those leaders of the founding generation were so incredibly impressive that present 20th century recent presidents simply pale in comparison.
But Robert Caro is devoting four huge volumes to LBJ's leadership qualities.
Well, I think with good reason, because LBJ really did things. The thing about the early presidents, the founding leaders, is that they not only did things, but they were so intellectually impressive. When you think of it, going back to that period, which I've done a lot recently in studying leadership, and looking what happened at the beginning of our country, and I know we hear it in high school and it sounds kind of boring perhaps to some people, but when you put together the revolution and then establishing a new government under the Constitution and having a strong president as our first president, which Washington was, and then passing the Bill of Rights, which is so important to you and me particularly, and then the election of 1800, where we for the first time demonstrated that a party in power would yield to a party in opposition. Well, I run all those five things together because it takes tremendous brain power, as well as political ability to put through a series of events like that. When you compare what's happened in other countries that simply haven't been able to do that.
And that's because these men were exceptional? Even the ones who have major warts? Thomas Jefferson keeps on receiving worse and worse press these days.
Well, there's kind of a continuing argument between the John Adams lovers and the Thomas Jefferson lovers, and it's fine to have that go on. But, you know, they were both great men in their own way.
Well, some people have seen that as a way of arguing the Bill Clinton, whoever else, debate with Jefferson taking the Clinton role, and somebody, I guess, like George W. Bush taking the Adams role.
Well, I think it's a little early to, even though, interestingly, Bill Clinton, with a middle name Jefferson and a last name Clinton, just stop for that. I think you New Yorkers were rather strange not to pick up more on the Clinton aspect. I mean, I don't think he's related to the great New York State Clintons. But there it is, right, with the word Jefferson. But in terms of the overall presidency, I'm one of those who feel that Clinton was much too much a moderate, a Democrat, much too much a centrist, a negotiator, and so on. As for Bush, I think Bush had obviously a great period. 9/11 gave him the opportunity, and he seized it, and he did just the right thing.
Does war have an effect on the way we finally judge a person's leadership? Because that's something that, in this case, he has decided to go into. In other cases, presidents have had wars forced on them.
Well, the interesting and perhaps rather sad thing is that the great presidents, virtually all of them, were war presidents. The only exception was another New Yorker, Theodore Roosevelt. He would have loved a war. But he didn't have a war.
He went to war.
But he went to war earlier. but he never got one during his presidency. But the other presidents did. Now, Bush, it depends a lot, of course, on what happens. The presidents connected with the Vietnam War don't gain very much from that historically, so we have to wait and see. But the thing about Bush that interests me is that he never had, until now, to make a big decision. I mean, what he did after 9/11 was great, but it was very obvious what you had to do. It was sort of a no-brainer. Today, he may have, in fact, very soon now, to make some huge decisions about what to do in Iraq if things go badly there.
Didn't you say in a recent interview that the war in Iraq won't be the greatest test of George W. Bush's presidency, rather North Korea will be?
I raised that possibility, that, and that's a good question, because North Korea really makes you think. I mean, that's where you've got to work out a strategy. Iraq, it was obvious if you took his basic position that you just go in there and try to clean them up. North Korea is quite different.
Your first book on leadership is widely acknowledged as having changed the way academics think about leadership. Is there wide agreement now on how leadership is to be defined?
Yes. There's considerable agreement, but still controversy. But some of us define it very much in terms of values. We believe that the great leaders lived up to great values. And again, that sounds very pious, but we're talking about values that came out of the Enlightenment. One reason the great leaders, the great presidents were great leaders, is that they had a very strong grasp on values coming out of the Enlightenment.
So that, you would say, would be more important than a person's individual abilities or the circumstances that he or she finds himself in?
Yes, I do, because the other things you can, like Roosevelt, you can sort of manipulate the events, the immediate problems, and so on. The values are there. They're in the American people. They're in the great presidents. And these are the ones that both sustain you and guide you. And just since this is rather vague to talk about values, they're beautifully summed up, getting back to Jefferson and Adams, in the Declaration of Independence, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness. A lot of people say that we don't have strong values by which we measure leaders. I disagree. I think we do have definite values by which to measure them.
But don't they all fail on some level? FDR resisted pressure to create more racially equitable laws. He didn't allow Jews to come into this country. Many died because he wouldn't change immigration policy. And we can go on. There are any number of other things that he's been faulted with.
That's right. That's one reason I, to get back to our earlier conversation, like to talk much more about the early presidents than I do about the later ones. I mean, FDR was a great president, but he was a manipulator. He was sometimes a liar, I hate to say. He made one fateful error that he should never be forgiven for, which was the putting Japanese Americans by the tens of thousands into what I call concentration camps. So to say that there are these explicit values doesn't mean people live up to them, but you can measure people. For example, Roosevelt fails to meet the test of liberty when he puts Japanese into concentration camps.
My guest is James McGregor Burns. His latest book is called Transforming Leadership, and it is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. So what is transforming leadership?
Transforming leadership means big change. It means intended change, not something, things that just sort of happen, but things that are planned by people.
But then it also means the ability to empower followers to,
absolutely,
to affect change.
That's the crucial aspect of it. You're not a dictator leading or directing subjects. You're a democratic leader developing followers into future leaders who might lead yourself.
Are they born, do you think, or are they created by circumstances?
I think they're mainly created by circumstance.
And what's the difference between a leader and a ruler? Is it simply one is democratically elected and the other isn't?
Yes, but it's beyond that. A ruler rules subjects. A leader mobilizes followers.
So how does that affect our assessment of someone like Hitler or Stalin?
I don't accept Hitler as a leader, even though he talked about the Führer, etc. To me, Hitler was simply a tyrant. But this is a very important question. It comes up a lot in the discussion of leadership. To me, Leonard, leadership is a good thing, a positive thing. In fact, people call for leadership. They don't necessarily call for good leadership. By leadership, they mean something positive. The other is rulership of subjects. I think there's a profound difference.
But don't you include de Gaulle on the ruler side rather than the leader side? He was a democratically elected leader.
Well, I put him more on the democratic side. I mean, you can argue, yes, you could argue either way, but more a democrat than a ruler.
So we talk about the way these people are transformed into leadership, but you also describe transactional leaders. What is a transactional leader? Somebody like LBJ
who knew? Well, he was both, and FDR was both. A transactional leader to me is the typical American politician who's a negotiator, a wheeler and dealer, an arbitrator, a mediator, a connector, give and take, the kind of thing we hear about being a moderate, you know, sitting around the table and settling things. And I don't denigrate transactional leadership. It's what we do all the time. It makes the world go round. We have to agree in families and businesses and so on, politics. You have to have a lot of give and take.
A lot of deal-making.
Deal-making, essentially. But, Leonard, you've got to rise above that when the great crises face countries. And I think that's what FDR did do. That's why I subtitled my book, The Lion and the Fox. He was a lion as well as a fox.
And the best leaders, the transforming leaders, include a Gandhi, a Martin Luther King Jr., Abraham Lincoln, Nelson Mandela. Any others?
Well,
I mean, some of them would also be called moral leaders, wouldn't they?
I call them moral leaders. And again, if you don't mind my being sort of nationalistic about this, I would go back to the founding fathers because they were all these things.
My guest is James McGregor Burns, winner of both the Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award. His latest book is called Transforming Leadership. It is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break here on WNYC. Coming up later in the show, Valerie Martin joins me to explore the damage done to slave and master alike. She's written a new novel called Property. That's here on WNYC 93.9 and WNYC.org. WNYC has adjusted its schedule, and for the latest on the war right now, you can turn to our sister station, AMA 20, for the BBC World Service. Either way, stay with WNYC to stay informed.
WNYC is supported by Working Today, a nonprofit that advocates for portable health insurance, now offering a hip health plan to qualifying freelancers and the self-employed at workingtoday.org or 1-888-7-WORKING.
Next time on Soundcheck, we look ahead to the first season of the new Zankel Hall, the new concert performance space at Carnegie Hall, with Ara Guzalemian. And live music in our studio from the members of the Cassatt String Quartet. Also a trip down memory lane with WNYC archivist Andy Lancet. I'm John Schaefer. Join us for Soundcheck weekday afternoons at 2 at 93.9 WNYC.
This is WNYC 93.9. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate talking to James McGregor Burns, who is senior scholar at the Jepson School of Leadership Studies at the University of Michigan, of Richmond. I wound up putting you into Michigan because I've been thinking about the Supreme Court case. Also Woodrow Wilson Professor of Government Emeritus at Williams College, author of numerous books, including Leadership, Roosevelt, the Lion and the Fox, Roosevelt, the Soldier of Freedom, The Deadlock of Democracy, the American Experiment Presidential Government, The Crucible of Leadership, and most recently The Three Roosevelts, written with Susan Dunn, this latest by James McGregor Burns himself, Transforming Leadership, from Atlantic Monthly Press. Much of what you have talked about comes out of your academic side. Have you ever had a more practical experience? Didn't you run for Congress once?
Yes, I ran for Congress. I was also in World War II in something of a leadership position, though at a very low level. And I'm very concerned about the practical application of leadership, actually. And in this book, I have an epilogue in which I present presumptuously, perhaps, a major shift in the way we deal with poverty, global poverty.
Which we'll get to later. But I wonder about your experience running for office. In retrospect, do you think you would have been as comfortable being a leader as you've been writing about leaders and leadership?
Well, I think being a leader is very uncomfortable, typically. And I think one thing that happens in running for Congress and even not getting into Congress, and I also incidentally worked on Capitol Hill for a time.
A presidential advisor.
Well, I was a presidential advisor in a small way, but also I was an intern on Capitol Hill just after getting through college for a year. I learned a lot about practicality there, I can tell you. But leadership is tough. And, for example, running for Congress back in the 1950s was a lesson in ideology. Running into a lot of people in western Massachusetts who were told that I was a communist, an atheist. In Massachusetts, you're never just a communist. You're an atheistic communist. And,
but it's one of the most liberal states, isn't it?
It is today. But in western Mass, it was very Republican territory. Hadn't voted Democratic since the Civil War. And it's quite interesting to deal with people who really think of you as the enemy and who may be personally very pleasant, as some of the Monsignors were, for example. But, I mean, they would receive me and we'd have a delightful talk, and then 2 days later they'd be in the Holy Name Society denouncing me up and down.
So that was a lesson. As an atheistic communist.
Yeah.
So you never had the opportunity to really test it all out. But working in the White House, those three administrations, they all work differently, I'm sure. How much could you actually see as an advisor?
Well, I was not... I should make clear, I was not a major advisor, but I was there partly because I wanted to see. And I saw some very interesting contrasts, obviously, between JFK and LBJ. And what I saw in LBJ was a man who desperately wanted to be a great president. I don't think JFK thought in terms of being a great president. I think he had a lot of self-assurance to begin with. But LBJ wanted to be a great president, and he did some great things, by the way, lasting legacy, but we all know what happened.
Well, I think a lot of people would say that JFK had charisma and LBJ didn't. How important is charisma to successful leadership?
Well, I think that's a good example of where it can be fairly important, but the trouble is charisma can be very artificial. I like to talk more in terms of heroic leadership than charismatic leadership. Charisma carries with it a kind of irrational aspect. And most of politics is a very practical, rational type of sets of disagreements. But to get back to LBJ, it was really a shame that he didn't project better and he did not have the touch, but it was even a greater shame that the main burden of Vietnam fell on him.
You mentioned earlier that transforming leaders possess a special ability to empower their followers. We know a lot more about the leaders than we ever know about the followers. Is it important to know about them?
It's important to know about the potential of the followers.
Well, what role do followers play in shaping what the leaders do?
Well, I could give you a wonderful example from the FDR presidency where Roosevelt started off as a very kind of moderate. We don't realize this now. You know, we hear about the great first 100 days, but he was experimenting, not sure what he was doing. And things did not go too well for the first year or two of the New Deal, 33 and 34. The huge amount of unemployment continued. And then he began to be attacked by some great characters named Huey Long, senator from Louisiana, and Father Coughlin of Detroit, and Dr. Townsend. The three of them were strong populist leaders. They were arousing the followers in a way that FDR did not. And the big question there, and this was a very practical test of Roosevelt's leadership, was what would he do by about late 1934? Would he continue his sort of moderate New Deal approach, or would he try to fend these people off by going left? And he went left. And I always urge students when I talk about this fascinating period, if they want to know what politics was like back in the 1930s, they should look at the second 100 days of 1935, when the enduring New Deal was passed, Social Security, National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act, graduated income tax, and all the rest. That's the enduring New Deal. We've forgotten about most of the first New Deal. But I like to tell them not only to study 1935, to see how he headed off the populists who were attacking him, but also to play the tape of the Madison Square Garden speech that Roosevelt gave at the end of the 1936 campaign. He ended up here in New York, as usual. And if one wants to get a sense of the strength of feeling of that time and of the intense conflict, listen to Roosevelt. At last he's getting back at all his opponents who have been calling him a communist too and all the rest for 2 or 3 years. And he talks about the economic royalists, as he called them, the conservatives attacking him. And he says, just to give one sentence, he says, "These economic royalists have been attacking me. They hate me, and I welcome their hatred." Mm-hmm. And Leonard, even on this old tape, you can hear this Madison Square Garden uproar. They love it. And I like this little period because I think politics should be sharper, more divisive. I believe in conflict leadership, that people really battle things out in terms of their fundamental convictions.
Do great leaders only emerge in times of crisis? Would a leader's greatness go unnoticed during a peacetime or in a time of economic prosperity? Would we take him or her for granted?
It's very likely. But again, Theodore Roosevelt is a great example, another New Yorker, of a president who did not need a crisis to be a very strong president. He was a kind of a crisis man in himself.
He created the crises and then fixed them. You say nothing is more common in politics than the unheard voice. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean the people I'm most concerned about, particularly around the world, the people who suffer. If we could go international for a moment, 2 billion people, Leonard, who not only suffer, they suffer in silence. They have no voice at all. They don't know how to have a voice. But getting back to America, there are millions of Americans who suffer, who are in great deprivation. Part of their poverty is that they don't know what to do about their poverty.
Do you think that the poverty crisis is, in fact, a crisis of leadership?
Yes, to the extent that we don't address it globally. I mean, to a great extent, we have tried to address it in this country, as we've just been discussing. Globally, we try to deal with it through very good programs like the Peace Corps and all the other wonderful programs that you know about, and also through the World Bank and great international foundations and corporations. But it doesn't get down into the grassroots of poverty, most of it.
Because you say the poor cannot pick themselves up by their bootstraps because they don't have any bootstraps.
Exactly.
James McGregor Burns, his book Transforming Leadership, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. This is WNYC 93.9, also online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Can poverty be changed from the top down, or does it need to be addressed from the bottom up?
I believe now we have to address it from the bottom up. or to put that more exactly, that we need leaders who really will know how to appeal to the bottom, mobilize the bottom, help them understand what they have to do, and then, like in the case of FDR, who finally won that election, I should have mentioned, he won it so big, the populace only got about 2% of that vote in 36. So eventually, the leader has to be practical and win elections in order to carry on the effort. But that means mobilizing people on a massive scale.
But don't most of the people who are capable of doing that also have demagogic leanings, often totalitarian leanings? You mentioned a number of populists who did very well in this country for a while, and I was thinking of other people who have mobilized the poor, like Perón. Hitler and Mussolini said that they were ciphers of the public sentiments. They understood what the public wanted.
That's why it's so crucial to maintain two great institutions from our ancient history. One is fair and open elections, and the other is a free press, free radio, the Bill of Rights. These people flourish when they can crush the opposition.
Some people are upset about the way we run our elections right now. Again, after the last election, complaints about the Electoral College and also about the fact that we elect presidents by pluralities. In other places, they will have runoffs, or in some, I think in Sweden, they have a weighted system where you have the equivalent of a runoff because you pick a first and second choice.
Well, there are interesting possibilities, but I think the main reason we have low turnout gets back to much of our discussion. They don't see a big choice. They see transactional leaders as against transforming leaders, to use my language, and they're not very excited by this, and why go to the polls when it doesn't make any difference?
Well, we're caught in a bind, aren't we, when there are partisan politics in Washington. Everybody complains that has led to stalemates. And then when people do speak out, as we have seen recently on another level, they are called obstructionists, unpatriotic. Anybody who complained about this war in Congress was really in for it. You're suggesting that partisan politics is the best way to conduct business, aren't you?
Absolutely, but the question is, what kind of partisan politics? Do you have two parties that really stand for distinct things so that people have a choice? Leonard, you might be intrigued to know that I rather admire Ronald Reagan, because here was a man of conviction in the great conservative tradition of this country who made no bones about being a conservative. He was proud of it, as he had a right to be.
And he pretty much lived up to his agenda.
Exactly. And that's where you really had a choice. But when you choose between a Clinton, who's such a moderate, and between a Bush, or whoever might be running against him, who's another moderate, you're choosing between somebody who is about 2 points to the left and somebody else 2 points to the right. What kind of a choice is that?
So you think Gore and Bush were pretty much the same thing?
I think Gore began his campaign on a very strong note of an alternative agenda. I think something happened to blur that during Gore's campaign. And Bush just carried on a typical conservative Republican campaign. So a lot of people did not see a great choice in that election.
You've said that the Constitution is highly resistant to modernization. Would you like to see it modernized?
Yes, I would.
In what ways?
Well, there are a lot of ways, but one that I would most like to see may seem rather small, but to me it's important as an old congressional campaigner, and that is shifting from the two-year congressional term, to 4-year term.
Because they spend so much time running for re-election all the time.
I often think about a typical woman who wants to really be a congresswoman, and who finds out she has to raise $1 million to even run. And then as soon as she's done that, if she gets elected, she has to start raising the next $1 million. Money is awfully difficult for these people.
Well, what are your thoughts on term limits?
I do not believe in term limits. I'd rather leave that up to the people who are voting. But I just want to get back, because you raised such an important issue about the money, in terms of the 4-year term. But I should add that means also the Senate senators would have a four-year term, and that would group everybody together, so you'd have a much clearer choice every 4 years about the president, the congressman, and the Senate.
And people would be more likely to vote than to stay away on an off year when all they're voting for is a senator or their local representative in the House.
Absolutely.
Because people do vote the most during presidential elections, don't they?
Yes.
You have given us a sense of what you think about the current political situation, and I get the feeling that the reputation you've had of being a bit of a pessimist may actually be true. Do you think of yourself as a pessimist or just a practical person in bad times?
I am a pessimist about the American constitutional system, and I'm so glad, Leonard, that you raised this question, because I think we're trying to operate in the 21st century under an archaic constitution that has kind of problem we just talked about, plus a structure that makes very hard to figure out who does what in the system. So everything is very confused at election time. Did the senator do it? Did the president do it? Did the congressman do it? And so on. So, yes, I am pessimistic about the Constitution, but I'm not pessimistic about the American people.
Hmm. Well, the American people, when they're asked about the Constitution, especially the Bill of Rights, are rather ambivalent at times. Right now, there are a lot of people who would like to see the First Amendment change just a little bit.
I'm only too aware of that and terribly distressed by that. But I think when the chips are down, people will fight for their own liberties. Despite the times we're going through where there's a lot of violation of individual liberty, I don't think it will last all that long. I think the people will be there. The problem is, will they be able to amend the constitutional system in the way we discussed?
James McGregor Burns' latest book is called Transforming Leadership. I imagine this is the last book you'll write about leadership for a while. Do you have something else
well,
in the pipeline?
I'm terribly interested at this point in leadership during the Western Enlightenment. And that's a wonderful period of leaders of all sorts, poets, philosophers, et cetera, et cetera. That's what I'm working on now.
And I look forward to seeing you to talk about that.
Thank you.
This book is published by Atlantic Monthly Press, and it has been my great pleasure to speak with James McGregor Burns today.